Hello and welcome to another edition of The Bunker, your daily dose of intrigue from the worlds of politics, current affairs, economics and related nightmares. I'm Andrew Harrison. I'm glad this recording shows how heated I am, because you are a dishonest journalist. There is no honesty in you at all, and I hope you will play this recording to your publishers as well before they fucking publish a pack of lies. It's not exactly a quote that you'd put on the back of your book, but it's a hell of a way to start one. In this case, an exploration of global corruption called Cuckoo Land, where the rich own the truth. Those are the words of Mohamed Amersi, Conservative Party donor, businessman, self-styled entrepreneur, philanthropist and thought leader, and loser last year of an acrimonious defamation case against the former Conservative MP Charlotte Leslie. Private eye readers will be very familiar with that action, which was described by David Davis MP in the Commons as a slap, strategic litigation against public participation. The man Mr. Amersi is talking about, in a conversation right in the offices of the much-feared lawyers Carter Rook, is the book's author, investigations correspondent at The Guardian, Tom Burgess. And the book they're talking about, or The Pack of Lies, as Mr. Amersi has it, uses the format of a thriller to follow the businessman's lively and well-connected career, from allegedly facilitating lucrative telecoms deals in shady places like Uzbekistan and Nepal, to accruing political influence here in the UK. Along the way, Burgess encounters dictators, stupendously greedy go-betweens, legal enforcers and vast sums of money, all bolstering a system where, he says, the rich are powerful enough to decide what the truth is. Well, if that's the case, what are we going to do about it? Tom Burgess is here with me today in the bunker. How are you doing, Tom?
Yeah, all right. Very nice to be here.
Glad to have you here. First up, we put ourselves in your hands here. For God's sake, don't get us sued.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, this is part of the point of the book, actually, that, yes. I think that people, when they pick up their newspapers or tune into their podcasts or open their books, have no idea, usually, that underneath the surface has been a huge amount of censorship conducted by an entire industry that's at the service of the rich and what they want the narrative to be.
Yeah, and the handy word within the trade is, I'm sorry, it got legaled.
Yeah. It got legaled. Yeah. As in, you know, quite often it's never going to see the light of day.
Yeah. So this is ostensibly the story of Mohamed Amersi, but it kind of isn't, is he? He's like the window through which we see a system of international enrichment, handshakes and so on, stuff which often, but not always, stays just the right side of corruption. What got you started on this story in particular?
So I'm going to go back for a moment, if I can, to when I went a few years ago to one of the trips I did to Kazakhstan. So a lot of my time I've been a foreign correspondent and living in West Africa and traveling to the former Soviet Union, that kind of thing. And about 10 years ago, there was a trial in a town by the Caspian Sea. And during this trial, a dozen or so ordinary Kazakhs, people who worked in a big oil field in the middle of the steppe, like a desert, basically, they confessed to having caused civil unrest in the town of Zhanaozen on Independence Day, at the end of which about a dozen people were dead. And during this trial, these people said, yes, I'm terribly sorry for this appalling offence against the public order and safety that's had these tragic consequences. And they were jailed for up to 7 years. And that's what the public record, the judicial record, shows in Kazakhstan. And I think the best word is probably snuck to Zhanaozen a few years later, and I spoke to people there about what had gone on before that trial. And I don't need to tell the whole story now, but I was speaking to people about how their loved ones had been killed, how they had been horrendously tortured by the regimes, the dictatorships, security forces, in order to create an alternative reality. So what had actually happened was the regime security forces had shot up a trade union protest. But what the record shows is that these victims had themselves been the instigators. And you see that again and again. You see that in Putin's Russia. You see that all around the world. And then during the pandemic, I was back here, as we all were, and I heard about a dispute within the Conservative Party and how law firms in the UK were being used to, let's say, curate, control, adjust, censor the public record. And it got me thinking as I pursued that particular story, and I've been sued myself in the High Court, I know a bit about what this is like. It got me thinking about what is actually the difference between a political society like the UK and Kazakhstan's, you know, big dictatorship just underneath Russia. And I think the heart of it is that the public record in a country that likes to consider itself free The public record is free. It's contested. Anyone can go to the public square and without, yeah, fear of maybe being shouted at and contradicted, sure, but without fear of suffering, without fear of punishment, can make a claim to the truth. And that's kind of the definition of a free society, right? And that's what is completely absent in Kazakhstan, and it's enforced in the torture chambers near the Caspian Sea. And what I started to realise quite terrifyingly is that, sure, no one's getting tortured in the UK, but there is another system that allows the powerful to control the public record. And it happens through lawyers and PRs, and it happens through the collapse of large parts of the media industry. And the upshot is that if you are rich enough today, I fear, you can decide what you want reality to be. And by force of your wealth and the fear it inspires, you can impose that reality on the world. And that's what this book is about.
So who exactly is Mohamed Morsi? What kind of role does he play in the system that you kind of travel the world investigating in this book?
So I heard about Mohamed Morsi 3 years ago, and I heard that there was a dispute within the Conservative Party, right? So what had happened was that Mohamed Morsi wanted to take a role. He was a big donor to the Tories, rich man, big donor. He wanted to have a role in the party's kind of liaison in the Middle East. Someone else held a very similar role. That was Charlotte Leslie, who used to be an MP. He had lost her seat and was doing that role. And Charlotte Leslie did a bit of Googling, asked a few questions about Morsi's background, put that in a memo and sent it to some people within the party. And Morsi got hold of this memo, said, this is an outrageous smear against me. He was raising a few questions about where he made his money in places like Russia and a few other things. And he says, this is an outrageous attack on me by someone who is threatened by me and just wants to destroy me. And he hired one law firm, first of all, called Mishkondareya, big one, and another one called Carter Rock, both absolute heavyweights of what you call the reputation management industry. And they started sending a lot of letters to Charlotte Leslie, threatening her with all sorts of ruin unless she retract. She didn't retract. And for 3 years, that case went through the High Court. An extraordinary spectacle, actually, of how the courts are a battleground for the truth. And the thing that struck me, I've spent a lot of my time as an investigative reporter going around, as I say, all over the world, trying to follow money trails, seeing how authoritarian regimes enrich themselves at the expense of their people through mining deals, oil deals, telecoms deals, whatever it may be. And I thought, if someone is reacting with such hostility to some questions about his past, I wonder what that past is. So that's what I took myself off to do. And that involved going to Scandinavia, going to Nepal, working at my old contacts in Kazakhstan. The full-scale invasion of Ukraine had started by then, so I couldn't go back to Russia. But I did follow a thread that led right back into Vladimir Putin's days in St. Petersburg. And that what all these things have in common here is that Mohamed Morsi worked on business deals in all of these places, in the telecoms industry, which was, from the invention of the mobile phone, the great boom industry of the last 30 years, with huge Western companies trying to spread into all these new, as they would see, the markets. But in doing so, going into business with regimes that are despotic, cruel, and corrupt. Now, Mohamed Morsi would say that every business deal he's ever done is absolutely 100% legit and clean, and it's an outrageous slur to suggest anything else. But in the book, what I do is raise some questions about those deals and what he should have known or might have been expected to know about who was enriched through them.
In Uzbekistan, we encountered the stunningly avaricious Gulnara Karimova, the daughter of the Uzbek dictator. She's a politician. She's a fashion designer. She's a pop star.
Yeah, Gugusha.
Yeah,
pop star
Gugusha.
Name, yeah.
Google it. Known locally as the Princess. And you report her making a casual demand for $250 million to facilitate a telecoms deal. She's a real standout. Well, there are a lot of characters similar to this, aren't they, in the dramatis personae of Cookie Land.
Yeah. One of the things that's really struck me about this world of the super rich is that it's hilarious. Suddenly you turn around the corner and there's the torture chamber and there's the horror underneath it all. And there's Navalny dying in prison. But actually, a world where really, really rich people are absolutely insisting that they are who they want to be. Like, I've got some lovely children, and one of the 2-year-old is pretty adamant he's a dinosaur. And you know, more power to him. Mm-hmm. Lovely, lovely chap. It isn't, in fact, a dinosaur, however. And eventually he's going to have to reckon with that reality as he grows older. And there is something extraordinary about people with so much money and access, crucially, to either the ultra-repressive apparatus that Gulnara Karimova has, thanks to her dad being the dictator of Uzbekistan, or the kind of private sector version of that, the UK legal industry. Mm. People just saying, and often on incredibly petty details, no, this is what reality is going to be. Mm. It's like, imagine you saw the whole world as your Facebook page, and you just insist on the right for it to be what you want it to be. And that often leads to, I mean, moments like there was one moment in the defamation case, right? So when it goes to the High Court and Amercy is suing Charlotte Leslie for defamation. Mm-hmm. There's an extraordinary moment when Amercy's barrister is on his feet in court saying, "My lord, I warn you, what follows is pretty graphic. The smear on my client's character." And what actually has been said is a reference to a Trollope novel, which is, as you can imagine, is not, you know, it's not D.H. Lawrence. It's not particularly graphic. Yeah. It's just a reference to a slightly unpleasant character.
Sebastian Melmotte.
Precisely.
Yes.
Yes. And so you do get these moments of sort of high comedy, but of course beneath it, well, maybe even low comedy, but beneath all of that is this huge problem, I think, that our the way the sausage is made, the way our public record is made, is not clear. I think most people think that journalists go out, they try and find out what they can find out, hopefully in good faith, and they try to report it pretty honestly. And there's a bit of to and fro about whether you get it right. But what you don't see is that almost all investigative work becomes shaped by legal threats. Mm. And I think it's pretty clear that a lot of journalists self-censor. They choose not to write about people known to be litigious. And why does this matter? In a way, you might just think, well, you know, the rich and powerful being able to keep the old story out of the papers. But the story of our time, from Putin to Trump, and all points in between, not that there are necessarily that many, is how these kleptocrats, those who seize power through corruption and rule through corruption, are coming to dominate geopolitics, and how they use their money to infiltrate democracies, whether that's through political donations, philanthropy, and the arts, the corruption of democratic institutions like the courts and parliaments, House of Lords. That is the most pressing story of our time, and it's also the one that is getting most censored. Mm-hmm. And it's a great betrayal of the interests of us all. This is our job, to tell the most important story of our time, journalists. Mm. And huge parts of that we're unable to tell, or we fail to tell.
Now, in your conversation with Mohamed Amersi, which is the framing of this book, it's this astonishing kind of, we keep returning to the offices of Carter Rook,
yeah,
where the biscuits are really nice and the atmosphere of threat is deadly.
Yeah, I didn't eat the biscuits, but they looked extremely expensive, yeah.
Yeah, they're not going for Tesco's biscuits, it's at Carter Rook.
No, they're not Tesco's biscuits. I don't think they're even, I mean, I guess Waitrose biscuits. Maybe they're not even in a supermarket,
actually. They might even be Dutchy Originals. But in your conversation with him...
Wouldn't rule it out.
He kind of makes the point, and I'm paraphrasing here, that if you're going to do business in places like these, this is the way business is done in places like these. And he's very insistent that he's never crossed the line into corruption, but it's a different kind of facilitation that goes on in places like Uzbekistan, Nepal, you know, anywhere former Soviets. And his point to you is, who are you as a British journalist to tell the Uzbeks or the Nepalis that they can't have a mobile phone network because business practices there don't comport with how we do in the West?
Right.
That's his argument, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, you've slightly bowdlerised that, actually. I believe he calls me a moral right wanker, among other terms.
Yeah, well, yeah. We'll come to the fruity language shortly.
Yeah, right, OK. Yeah. But so one of the several confusing things about that day, where, yes, I sat across, as you and I are sitting now, except lovely studio, though it is, a slightly grander room, at the offices of Carter Rock. No other lawyers present, recorder on the table, as agreed, and a big stack of documents he wanted to show me. One of the strange things was that some of what he said seemed to be contradictory. So, for instance, every specific deal he was involved in was completely legit and had been signed off by lots of well-qualified people. That is his position, and he offers some evidence for that. However, when you zoom out to this question of, well, how on earth are Western companies that are supposedly covered by anti-bribery laws at home able to do business in countries that everybody knows are wildly corrupt, or their countries aren't corrupt, are they? Their political elites are are terribly corrupt. Surely that's going to involve some corruption by definition. I mean, no corrupt regime is going to let Andrew Inc. just walk on in and get an oil field without taking a cut. So when Mohamed Morsi was talking in that big scale, he was saying, like, who are you? Who the fuck are you to try and impose some sort of moral code? Which seemed to me to be saying, yeah, of course there's corruption that happens in these deals. Of course there's corruption that happens in doing business in these countries. But that's how people get access to, as he said, the information highway, which is going to lead to, you know, the sunlit uplands of democracy and so on. So there seemed to be some pretty heroic assumptions in there. But on a sort of conceptual level, that was one of the confusing things. And then there was obviously the slightly more bonkers moments when he was telling me things about my own life.
Tells you were fired by the FT, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a fantastic exchange. Yeah.
I actually know I resigned to write a book.
Yeah, it starts to get, being sort of gaslit in that way, it starts to become really quite a weird experience. And you know, I'd worked at the FT for a long time. I was a foreign correspondent and then on the investigations team. And then I left to write this book. I wrote my first stories about Mohamed Morsi for the Financial Times. Went around this book and then joined The Guardian. And it was just quite odd being told, no, you were fired. And, you know, on everything else we're talking about, you know, the finer points of like a telecoms deal in Kazakhstan or the Nepali political order or, you know, his relationship with the royal family or so on. You know, it's journalism, right? It's a often quite robust interview. Mm. I mean, I was trying to just listen all day. That's the main thing to do. When you go in good faith to do these interviews, you listen and listen and listen. But on that one, I did feel I had to say, sorry, Mohamed, but I did resign. Mm. And he said, no, you were fired. I know people there. You were fired. And I said, can I ask why I was fired? He said, no, I don't want to get into that. And then he said, incompetence. And I mean, you know, I'm not saying I've got everything right, but I definitely wasn't fired for incompetence. And and then there was sort of further to and fro. I was like, oh, well, he probably let you resign to save face and so on. And that was a very strange sensation. And actually, that's why I think it helps the book to have this scene running all the way through it, because you do get that sense of actually what it's like to have a conversation with someone who apparently feels that they have the sole claim to reality.
I want to ask you about Mr. Morsi's relationship with the Conservative Party, and particularly with Ben Elliott, Queen Camilla's nephew. He runs the elite concierge service quintessentially, and he was until 2022 co-chairman of the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And we have the interesting situation that Mr. Morsi is a client of Ben Elliott at quintessentially, where he's providing concierge services, travel, concert tickets, things like this for the elite. And also Ben Elliott is raising funds for the Conservative Party and with contacts at the very, very highest levels of the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. How well did it serve Mr. Morsi in the end? Because he doesn't really get what he wants, does he?
I think there are clearly questions for Ben Elliott about a conflict of interest. On the one hand, he's got his company quintessentially his clients. He trades on being the guy who can get anything if you pay the company's astronomical fees. He can get you, you know, dinner on an iceberg or, you know, airdrop the right kind of tea bags to Madonna or whatever it may be. But then there's this moment in Morsi's career when he's done his telecoms deal work and he's launching into this new phase of being a philanthropist and a donor and so on. And Ben Elliott arranges for him to get on a plane. It's meant to be a private plane, but he ends up with the intolerable situation of having to get a commercial flight, but, you know, puts up with it and goes up to Scotland and is driven to Dumfries House, this beautiful old house in the countryside, there to meet his host for the evening, Ben Elliott's Aunt Camilla's husband, Prince Charles. And this is a pattern that if you are Ben Elliott's client or a client of quintessentially his company, you also get access to the family. Now then, as you say, Ben Elliott becomes chairman of the Conservative Party. And it's one thing to give paying clients access to the royals, but I think it's another when there's a blurring of the lines between who is your paying client and who are you favouring in a political position, a position as the co-chairman of the ruling party. And the dispute between Morsi and Charlotte Leslie really brings this out. And it's that blurring of the lines, whether it's in VIP contracts for COVID or in Ben Elliott's career in the Conservative Party, and there are dozens of other examples, that starts to become really worrying, because that's when you start to get this creeping idea that personal enrichment and politics can be mixed, and that's all right. And that's when you get to, that's when you start to undermine the heart of politics. But for a mercy, I mean, yeah, he's pretty pissed off with Ben Elliott because he feels that he wasn't given the support when this dispute with Charlotte Leslie started. He should have been given the support. He keeps saying, you know, I gave this party 750,000. Actually, a big chunk of that was donated in his partner's name, and we examine that in the book. But I think what it is, in a way, is a lesson in how the elite works today and how much access and status are for sale.
You mentioned the Charlotte Leslie case earlier on.
Yeah, right.
And that's kind of where this kind of broke the surface for most of us. This is when most of us, with our private eyes and our cups of tea, become aware of
it. Yeah, as ever, private eye, brilliant coverage. Yeah.
Mercy alleged that she defamed him, as you explained. The case was dismissed. Mr. Justice Nicklin said that Mr. Mercy had failed to prove serious harm had been inflicted on his reputation. And there's this bizarre moment where it all hinges on whether the opinion of Mr. Mercy had been lowered in the eyes of one person. That's the kind of root of the case.
Yeah, as I recall, I think that might have been Crispin Blunt.
Yeah, Crispin Blunt, that's who it is.
Yeah. I think he's the guy who made the Melmotte reference.
Oh, really?
From memory. Yeah, yeah. I think that was part of the argument of, well, if we could just go back one step. So
yeah.
So the you know, the UK is the libel capital of the world. Mm-hmm. Anyone who wants to beat someone over the head with a libel action tries to use the UK courts, including all manner of oligarchs, some of whom are now under sanctions, people very close to Putin. We can get into those cases. But people from all around the world, and including rich, powerful figures in the UK, the UK has a terrible problem that because of the sheer cost of it, if someone with lots of money goes for you for libel, for defamation, or in fact data protection these days, privacy, it's a massive problem if you're outgunned financially, because the risks are almost instantly in the millions. And it's terrifying, and this is where we get our self-censorship from. But I think it was in 2013 or 14, from memory, the law was changed to try to make this a little bit less ludicrous. So you had to be able to show that you had at least suffered significant harm, right? So it cannot just be some trivial nonsense that you're using to pick on someone. And that's where Mercy's case failed, is that he could not show that this supposedly dastardly smear campaign by Charlotte Leslie had resulted in any serious harm for his reputation. And this is why we ended up in these kind of ludicrous scenes of people saying, my lord, there's some terribly graphic language coming, and it's a reference from a Victorian novelist who has never used a graphic sentence in his life. The case ends up being thrown out. There are also questions about whether the court was misled. That's something that I think it's pretty clear that there was a witness statement by Mohamed Mercy that was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
The judge said that. The question now is about whether that was deliberate. Mr. Mercy would say absolutely it's not, and his lawyers would say absolutely it's not, but that merits certainly further investigation. Private eye has been writing about that too.
David Davis told the House of Commons afterwards that the result was a victory for free speech. He later described it as a landmark for press freedom and fair comment. Do you think he's right? Is the environment changing? Have we made progress against slaps?
Yes and no. I mean, it was a term that we never used to use. I think the fact that we're having this conversation, that there have been parliamentary hearings on this. I went with my great mate, Catherine Belton, before the parliamentary committee and talked about this. We'd both been sued by various oligarchs.
She's the author of Putin's People.
Catherine is the absolutely brilliant author of Putin's People, which is essential reading. And the inside story of Putin and his corruption and his spreading of his influence into the West. And just when we needed our journalists like Catherine Belton most in the run-up to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, she was taken off the field by people including an oil company run by Igor Sechin, Putin's personal enforcer, and various other oligarchs, Roman Abramovich. And her book came fighting through that. But it was an extraordinary example of slaps, right? of lawfare, as is the other term. And it's excellent that we're talking about this. There has been a little bit of legislation which might help. There's a private members bill before Parliament now, which is deeply flawed, but there are efforts to improve it. And I think we have to go much, much further, because essentially the problem is the financial motivations, the incentives that are available. If you are a young lawyer, there are life-changing amounts of money available if you are prepared to do this work, if you are prepared to go to one of the reputation management firms and enforce a kind of privatized censorship regime for your very rich clients. And I think some of the most perceptive and thoughtful experts and lawyers in this area would say that while those incentives stay like that, it's going to keep happening. It may not be libel law, maybe some other tool that's used, but we'll have to find a way to take the money out of it. So you can have absolutely have an honest dispute. What you can't have is you go too far the other way. And if there's a story about some poor guy who happens to live around the corner from someone who's been murdered, who looks a bit weird, all the press slap him on the front page as this is clearly the guy who did it. He has to have some recourse, absolutely, and some protection. The problem is the volume of money, because it doesn't become about the truth or even the law. It becomes war by wealth. And plenty of countries, France included, have a very cheap, cost-effective system of doing this. In the UK, we regard the legal industry as a massive export, and it is a huge money spinner. And that's the problem, because that is distorting what the courts are for.
Tom Burgess, thank you for joining me in the bunker.
Well, thanks very much.
Cuckoo Land, Where the Rich Own the Truth is available now, from William Collins. And if you buy a copy from the link in the show notes, you'll be helping to support the bunker, because we get a small taste of the proceeds, which isn't corruption. It's not corruption, right? It's okay. We're providing a service.
No, that's not the corruption. The corruption is that you then give a little bit back to me quietly in that brown envelope you're very kindly passing over. These cameras are off now.
You can have a packet of Dutchie Original Biscuits, better than Carter Rooks. Listeners, if you really want to help us, by the way, please consider backing us on Patreon. Podcasting, as you may have heard, is undergoing a testing period right now, and we need the support of listeners more than ever. So for as little as £3 a month, you'll be helping to keep us in existence and bringing you fascinating interviews like this. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.